Thank you again. This is really Rabbi Dr. Reichman's session, and what I did was I sent in advance a series of real cases. I get a lot of calls, at least once or twice a week, an email with some kind of specific question. Our research is done under what's called Institutional Review Board sanction, which means none of the samples are identified. I'm not involved in any commercial company or testing, and therefore we have no identity, and I tell the individuals that we are not in that, we don't do that. Yet I found the questions to be interesting from a halachic perspective, and I'm far from being a rabbinical halachic authority of any sort, and I always mention that, and I refer the individual to such an authority, and we have someone who spans both worlds, Rabbi Dr. Reichman. We have other scholars here, so I thought this would be a good opportunity. And so there are three cases. I've made some slight changes, but they're real, just to protect the innocent. I mean, obviously, the names are obviously not there, but even the country of origin or something like that is a little bit changed, just so really to stay away from any. So here's the first. And in each case, I'll just have one or two extra little slides just to put it into the perspective, although it may be redundant. I may skip them. 23-year-old religiously observant Kohen was introduced to the 22-year-old daughter of another Kohen who had married a divorcee, rendering the daughter halachically what's called a halala, and hence forbidden to marry A.A. I guess I made a mistake here. A.A. asked the following question. That's, if the Y chromosome DNA marker testing, if his Y chromosome DNA marker testing of A.A. and of the father of the young woman, that is C.C., come from paternal genealogic lineages which diverged long before the time of biblical Aaron, that is, these branches I had spoken about earlier, then this young man asked me, I said, please don't ask these questions, and not for me. He said, just hear me out. Is a scientific rationale correct that one or both of us are not from the seed of Aaron? So is this question scientific? Is there a scientific rationale that's valid here? And if so, is there a halachic implication? We, in the interest of time, I won't. There was a secondary question which arose later. How many kohanim are needed for a valid pidyon haben? But we can discuss that later. So this goes back to this question of the trees and the markers and the lineages which you saw. And let's say these two individuals, this young man and the prospective father-in-law, you know, one comes from RM269 and one from. So maybe neither of them are a Kohen, or just from the lineage of Aaron, or if one is, the other seems not to be, at least from our scientific knowledge. And that relates to this whole issue of relatedness. You've seen it. Second case, a 28-year-old Israeli woman is to marry an Israeli Jewish man in Israel. This relates to Dr. Oster's questions of the laws of citizenship, laws of return. There's also laws of marriage in Israel. And the woman immigrated at the age of 12 from the Ukraine, under the law of return, as we've heard. There is no documentation for Jewish identity of her paternal, there is documentation for Jewish identity of her paternal grandfather, but no comparable record with respect to her maternal side. The rabbinical courts in Israel refused to grant a marriage permit. She carried out, this really took place, a private DNA testing, direct-to-consumer, which showed that her mitochondrial, that is maternally transmitted DNA, is of this K1A sublineage shared with 1.5 million established, recognized Jews, recognized, let's say, by the rabbinical authorities in Israel, and was only found in one non-Jew who turned out to have Jewish maternal ancestry after all. Does the woman need conversion? And this relates to the mitochondrial DNA and the fact that really, you know, here I am with some of my grandchildren a few years ago, and here's a book that I tried to read to them to get them close to me, but they're not interested in their grandfather or their father, they're interested in their mother. And Judaism, as we heard back at least from the time of, in Talmudic times on, you know, has maternal rules as far as Jewish identity. And this whole case, these relate to this finding we had a few years ago, which we published, again, Dr. Bahar was the first author, about four founding mothers of Near East provenance gave rise to a large proportion of contemporary Ashkenazi Jews. One of them is this lineage that this woman actually had. And so she shares that with many recognized Ashkenazi Jews. I won't, you know, in the interest of time, I won't go into. This is one of the figures from the paper that appeared in 2006, the American Journal of Human Genetics, showing these different, these blue circles, showing these different matrilineal Ashkenazi lineages, which are found, where else do we find them? Among non-Ashkenazi Jews, which is gives us the circumstantial, and that was direct evidence, actually, that they're of Near East provenance. Here they are, and she was a member of one of them, K1A1B1A. Okay, so here's a little cartoon. Are you Jewish? My mother is Jewish, my grandmother is Jewish, my great-grandmother is Jewish. You know, so what do we say about that? The third case, another real case, a 55-year-old Brazilian man has a family tradition of descent from the conversos. He now adopts Jewish practices and customs and undergoes private DNA testing at the Y chromosome and mitochondrial DNA markers. The Y chromosome marker is shown to be in the GP58 haplogroup with a set of STRs, these rapidly microsatellites which I mentioned earlier, placing him in close proximity to many other Jewish males. His mitochondrial DNA, however, markers overlap those commonly found among non-Jewish Europeans. He makes the following claims. One, in fact, he says, I do not need conversion on the basis of a 16th century responsa stating that forced conversos and their descendants may return to Judaism by a process of declaration, a much easier sort of conversion light. And if one is not accepted, then he certainly claims that he's of the seed of Israel, Zera Israel, and therefore entitled to a lenient conversion. In other words, he doesn't have to go through the rigors of being turned away three times, etc., etc. Is this scientific rationale sound? Does it have any halakhic implications? And what are the society implications for the estimated tens of millions of lost potential Jews for all of Judaism? And this is from a study that I was just a minor collaborator on with Mark Jobling, in which he looked at Y chromosomes in the Iberian Peninsula by Balearic Islands, showing that in certain parts of Portugal and some of Spain and Balearic Islands, some up to 20% of contemporary male residents have Jewish male ancestry or markers consistent with Y chromosomes right there. So this is just a picture, a plug for where I come from, Rumbun Healthcare Campus, and we welcome the, sorry, this is the extra.
Great, thank you so much. Thank you very much, Professor Skorecki. Why don't you guys take a 30-second standing stretch just to get your minds going. Just parenthetically, if you do a Google search, you know, Maya Sen said there's 208,000 entries. 223,000. If you narrow that search to ancestry and shiduchim, you'll get about 207,000, I think. While you're standing and returning to your seats, should I give them a few minutes or should I give just a stretch? Yeah. Okay, actually, while everyone's returning to their seats after the blood's flowing, I'll share with you a very beautiful idea that I actually first heard from Rabbi Fold. And that was the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. So the Mishnah states, "Amahalech baderech v'shone u'mafsik mi'mishnaso ve'omir manor ilon zeh male alakosel kilu amishai v'nafsho." Translation being, the Mishnah says, if someone's walking in the street and he's learning, and he stops his learning, and he takes a look at the tree outside, and he said, how magnificent is this tree? The Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, this person has committed a capital crime. So what's the simple understanding of this? One might think the simple understanding is, you shouldn't stop your learning. If you're in the middle of learning, don't stop your learning to take a look at the tree. Jews are supposed to be the people of the book. You're supposed to take a look at the book and then never lift your eyes from the page. But what I heard from Rabbi Fold, and was echoed in the parish of Rosh Shimshon Fold Hirsch, is that the key word is mafsik. Mafsik is, you stop your learning. So if you're in the midst of learning, and you take a look at the tree, and the man is compared to tree, and you study genetics and anatomy and physiology, and you think that your study of this discipline of medicine is separate and distinct from your learning Torah, that is a capital crime. Because our understanding of all the medicine that we've learned today, our understanding of the genetics, our understanding of anatomy, physiology, these are all an integral part of the Torah, an integral part of understanding the human being, both the individual and the history of the human being from the times of Adam Harishon until today. So in that vein, we continue our discussion. Professor Scaretti has given me quite a tall task. Our conference obviously is running, unfortunately, a little late, but not too late. Of course, based on his questions, we could spend a number of hours discussing them. But my hope is to place today's conference really into a historical and halachic context about the interface of science and medicine, and more specifically, the interface of genetics and Jewish law. And we'll begin our discussion with a brief analysis of some references or allusions to genetics in rabbinic literature, followed by a discussion of the impact of genetics on the Jewish family, really in the modern era. Then we will address the acceptance of DNA testing in Jewish law, and then we will return to Professor Scaretti's questions about who is a Jew and who is a Kohen. We first begin with a discussion about genetics in the Bible and the Talmud, and some fascinating passages which allude to the possibility of genetics understood by our predecessors. First of all, we have from a book by Tony Bushby showing that the very letters of the Hebrew alphabet are similar in structure to the chromosomes and to the DNA. you can see that with other languages, perhaps. But even in the passages of the Torah that discuss Jacob and his dealings with Laban and the sheep, we're all familiar with the story that he had a number of sheep that he removed from the flocks, and he removed the spotted sheep and the dotted sheep and the speckled sheep. And he was able to proliferate these sheep into a tremendous herd. There have been many different analyses of exactly what that biblical story entailed, but a number of people, including one report here from William Edkin, discussed the fact that there may have been some genetics involved in how that progeny produced so rapidly and so quickly. In his article, Jacob's Cattle and Modern Genetics, a Scientific Midrash, and here you see actually the only chart or graph that I will have in my presentation today. Another famous passage which has been pointed to as a allusion to understanding of genetics is a passage which appeared in the Tractate of Yevamos, which talks about circumcision, and I won't read the passage inside, but it says in the passage that if a couple has a child that is circumcised and dies as a result of circumcision, then has a second child that dies of circumcision, should the third child be circumcised or not? So there is a sensitivity to the fact that there is something being transmitted from the parents to the children which is causing this condition. And in fact, the Talmud says later on in this passage that there was the case of four sisters from the city of Tzipori, and of these four sisters, three of them had children who died of circumcision, and the question was, should the fourth sister circumcise her child? So we see that there was a sensitivity to different forms of genetic transmission, not just from one couple, but to actually from sisters, and many people point to this passage as the earliest reference to the disease hemophilia, and it does jive with our genetic understanding of hemophilia being an X-linked disorder. Also on the topic of shiduchim, there is a sensitivity to transmission of disease and genetics of disease, which we actually spoke about more extensively in a previous conference, where the Talmud says, Lo yisa adam isha lo mi mishpachas nichvin v'lo mi mishpachas mitzorayim. That this is not a law, this is simply a sound advice or suggestion, that one should not marry into the family of Nichvin. Nichvin actually is epilepsy, or epileptic disorder, seizure disorder. V'lo mi mishpachas mitzoroin, and not into a family of lepers. V'hud ischazik tlasi zimni. However, it has to find its expression three times within the family. Again, a sensitivity to the fact of genetic transmission. Now, leprosy, for sure, is not specifically a genetic disease, but there was a perception of its genetic transmission at that time. But I'd like to spend the next few minutes addressing how the new field of genetics, before population genetics, to contextualize this conference into the history of Jewish law over the last few decades, how the Jewish community has encountered the field of genetics, and where today's conference finds its place within that historical context. The first real encounter with genetics in the Jewish community was with the field of carrier testing, which took place a number of decades ago when many of us are familiar, and we've had conferences discussing it, about the disease Tay-Sachs, which was really the first identifiable disease for which we could determine carrier status, which had widespread ramifications. And its impact on the Jewish community was obviously quite significant. In those earlier stages, here you have a cartoon which reads, "Scientists have isolated the gene that makes scientists want to isolate genes." And I think everyone on this podium has that gene. But in those earlier stages, in encountering this then new concept of genetics into the field of Jewish law, Rav Moshe Feinstein of blessed memory addressed the issue of in yesh livdok l'machalas Tay-Sachs kodem hanisuin, if one should engage in premarital testing in order to determine if you are a carrier and the possibility of marrying another carrier, and if one carrier marries another carrier for this condition, then there's a 1 in 4 chance that the progeny will have the disease Tay-Sachs. In that discussion, which one of these is the... And he said, I went into this analysis very thoroughly, and even though only a small percentage are involved in this, and one could argue, as he says, people did argue, that perhaps we should ignore the scientific developments. We should say God protects those who believe in him, and let wherever the chips fall, the chips may fall, and that's our belief, that's what we maintain. But he didn't say that. He said if we have the ability to test for these things simply and easily, and the result of our testing is the impact, the prevention of children being born with severe fatal disease, then not only is it permissible to do, but it borders on the obligatory to do, and it's clearly something which should be welcomed and has been the case for the many decades since. Another impact of this very testing, going through the history of rabbinic literature, is that women who were pregnant were able to test for this particular condition. And then the issue was at that stage in halachic history, but once it was determined that a child in utero was afflicted with a genetic condition, again at that stage, the only disease which was testable, and that has obviously radically changed since then, was Tay-Sachs disease, would it then be permitted to do something once you have that information? Can you act on that information? Specifically, can an abortion be performed or not? And I apologize, all of these obviously are lengthy discussions. This is really a survey. But just to share with you the polar extreme positions that exist to this very day, with a number of positions in between those two. On one extreme was Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, who claimed that an abortion would not be permitted for a fetal indication, even if it was determined with absolute certainty that the child was afflicted with Tay-Sachs disease. Abortion could not be performed, and this was based on his analysis of the understanding of the prohibition of abortion, of which there are a number of analyses, by the way. There is no uniform accepted approach to the prohibition of abortion in rabbinic literature. There are many different approaches. And on the other extreme, you have the position of the Tzitz Eliezer, who maintained that not only was it permitted to perform an abortion, but you could even perform that abortion until the 6th month of gestation. And his legal analysis was obviously different from the legal analysis of Moshe Feinstein. And those two polar extremes in the halachic landscape are still preserved today in terms of positions about the permissibility or prohibition of abortion. Moving forward a number of decades, couples who had this challenge where both were carriers and the only possibility open to them was if they became pregnant spontaneously, they would have to determine in a very arduous and emotional situation about whether or not to perform an abortion, whether it was halachically permissible or not permissible. Now the science has changed radically, and we have this new procedure called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, of which we again are very fortunate to have Rabbi Fuld with us, who spearheaded a center in Eretz Yisrael today, which is at the cutting edge of this technology and applying it very directly to the kinds of cases we're talking about today, and has already produced many, many children who have been free of disease as a result of this fascinating technology. How many? 154 Mirsa Shem should continue to grow. Just for my education, how many people in this room are aware of what of this term, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? So we have an educated crowd here. Let me just share with you very briefly, for those of you who are unfamiliar, what you are looking at here is the human embryo. It has actually been enlarged. That's not the real size. You're looking at the human embryo, the eight-cell embryo, and in the first slide, this is an embryo which is fertilized in the laboratory from the reproductive seed of the husband and the wife. And this is a pipette beginning to extract one cell. Here the cell is almost extracted, and here the cell is almost completely extracted. That one cell will then be sent to the laboratory for genetic analysis of anything that is testable at the time that you extract that cell. So obviously it's being used for diseases like Tay-Sachs and a whole variety of many other diseases. It can be used to determine gender of a child. It can be used to determine anything, again, which is knowable or testable or determinable at the time that that cell is removed. This itself obviously is a major halachic issue about the applications and ramifications of this technology, one that is firmly planted in the early 21st century, and Rabbi Fold's center in Eretz Yisrael, which has produced so many children, has an ethics committee which deals with these kinds of issues all the time in terms of which cases it would be permissible to use this technology for and which cases it would not be permissible to use this technology for. And another area which I'm sure you are all familiar with, where genetics has found its expression in the area interfacing with the Jewish community and with Jewish law, is breast cancer genetics. And the realization that a small percentage of those who develop breast cancer are genetically genetic in origin, and the Jews were identified as a population who are carriers to some extent in some percentages of this particular breast cancer gene, which is transmittable to subsequent progeny. And to give you an idea of the impact of the Jewish community on the genetic landscape in the general world, this is a first article in the New England Journal of a series called Genomic Medicine, which began, I don't have the exact date here, but it began within the last year or so. The very first article in a new series about genomic medicine is about an Ashkenazi woman who has the breast cancer gene. And that was the discussion in the medical community. It was not a Jewish conference here at Yeshiva University. It shows the impact of genetics in the Jews and on the world at large. Now, the halachic ramifications here are very widespread as well. The obligation to test, who should be testing, when someone should test, if they test, what should they do with that information, should they immediately run to the surgeon and perform a bilateral mastectomy and remove the breasts, the association not only with breast cancer, but with ovarian cancer, and how that impacts on fertility, because we know that there's a tremendous emphasis in Jewish law on procreation. So if you have a woman who's relatively young but has a risk for ovarian cancer, God forbid, should she remove her ovaries at a relatively early stage? Should she wait after she has progeny? How many progeny should she wait after she has these procedures? All these things are very complex areas which are being discussed by in contemporary rabbinic discussions, and another major area of the impact of genetics and of Jewish law. The definition of maternity is another one of those areas, an area which has no resolution, remains an intense debate, one of the most contested, hotly debated topics in modern medical ethics of the late 20th, early 20th century. And in the field of, we had an entire conference on the treatment of infertility, and in that conference we discussed many of the legal issues. One of those issues was in scenarios where you have a combination of genetics from one individual and a surrogate mother or a woman who gestates the child, who would be considered the legal mother in that kind of scenario? That's a very new development in the field of medicine. So is genetics the determinant of who is considered this child? Or is the gestation considered, or the birth, the determinant of who is considered that child? And very much impacts on our discussions today, because if one of the partners in this process is Jewish and one is not, is the progeny considered Jewish, or is the progeny not considered Jewish? And it gets to really the definition of Jewishness. And more importantly, who do you send a Mother's Day card to on Mother's Day? And of course, Hallmark maintains that both mothers are considered the legal mother. And it's gotten so complicated that you might actually see this personal ad. I was reform as an embryo, conservative as a fetus, and orthodox from birth, seeking same. But the present positions literally span the entire gamut, from no halachic mother to the genetic mother being considered the legal mother, to the birth mother being considered the legal mother, to both mothers being considered the legal mother. In a conference this past year in Israel, in PUA, which is an organization that deals with infertility in Jewish law, not that this was a consensus statement, but the statement came out from that conference that there seems to be a pendulum swing to some extent that now considers the genetic mother, the egg donor, to be considered the legal mother of the child from a halachic perspective. Again, Jews don't make absolute consensus statements. I wish they would. But it seems that the preponderance of rabbinic opinion has seemed to have shifted to the belief that it is the genetic mother who is considered the halachic mother. Now let's come to another area which is found its expression in Jewish law, and that is actually DNA testing, not of populations, which we have discussed here this morning, but DNA testing of an individual, and the relevance of that DNA testing of that individual, or the admissibility of that DNA testing into areas of Jewish law. Now this, as you can well imagine, is a very complex issue. What I'm just doing on these next two slides is summarizing the impact of genetic testing in a number of areas in Jewish law. And what I hope you'll appreciate from these slides is that even though we've had some wonderful testing, wonderful discussions today about genomics and lots of statistical probabilities, I think we will all agree that the statistical probability that DNA belongs to any one individual rises to a pretty high level of certainty in the modern age, to 99.99999% that DNA extracted from an individual is identified with that individual. Yet, despite that fact, you will see that in different areas of Jewish law, the admissibility of that evidence will vary significantly, even though it borders on 100% certainty that DNA will identify the individual. And here's a few kinds of examples. Example one, so in many of these areas, it has to do with someone who has died and the identification of the body. So case number one, or issue number one, is with respect to burial. Can DNA evidence be used, for example, to bury one body in one place, to identify all the parts of the body and unite them for burial in one location? So here there's a general consensus. DNA evidence may be used in order to bury body parts of an individual in one grave. By the way, these excerpts are from a consensus statement of a number of great rabbinic authorities in Jerusalem, including Rav Elyashiv and Rav Vosner, for those who have name recognition of those prominent rabbinic rabbis. And this isn't necessarily also agreed upon by everybody, but it was a consensus of some of the major rabbinic authorities. Now, what about mourning practices? What about if you have someone you don't know if they're alive or dead, and you find DNA, a sample, and you've determined that this DNA is of the person that you think is actually thought to be dead? Can you begin mourning practices for that individual just based on the DNA? So here you'll find a very interesting distinction, and the relevance of this distinction will become clear in just a moment. DNA evidence can be used to begin the mourning process for the death of an unmarried man, but for a married man or woman, the matter needs further analysis, lest the widow attempt to remarry without halachic approval. So let me clarify that for you. We'll actually clarify that on this slide, and I'll return to the other one in a moment. So where this found its expression most remarkably in our generation was with the tragedy of 9/11. There were, I don't know the exact number, but there were somewhere between 10 and 15 men who were thought to have died in that, who were religious Jewish men, who left women who were widowed by this tragic event. And the question was, could these men be identified legally as dead so that their wives could remarry? And if Jewish law could not confirm with 100% certainty that they had died, then the woman would remain in a status of aguna, which means that she would be unable to remarry forever. So in this institution, we have the dean of our rabbinic school, is Rabbi Yonah Ries, who at that time was actually headed up the Beis Din, the rabbinic court, and he is personally responsible for being involved in many of these cases. And the question is the DNA evidence that they extracted from the rubble sufficient to be able to determine with 100% certainty that that individual has died? So what's interesting is is that, and this is a consensus statement, again, obviously, as you can well imagine, very lengthy legal analysis, Amnam ein li smoch ach v'rach al bedika zu. So even though it is clear that the DNA comes from this individual and the scientific certainty rises to the level of almost absolute certainty, Jewish law does not allow that as the sole evidence to be able to determine that that person is considered legally dead and to allow the woman to remarry. And there has to be some kind of corroborative evidence. There has to be some other corroborative evidence. Why? Because Jewish law is not based on DNA. Jewish law is generally based on testimony. Half of rabbinic law is based on testimony. There has to be two witnesses that testify that an event occurred. And in that vein, there's fascinating discussions about the admissibility of DNA evidence in determining the illegitimacy of a child. So if you have a husband, for example, that suspects that the child is not his and refuses to give the monetary support to the child, and he goes to the laboratory and performs a DNA testing on himself and a DNA testing on the child, is that child, and the test determines with absolute certainty that this is not his child, is that DNA evidence admissible in a court of law, or is it not admissible in a court of Jewish law? So the fascinating thing is that the majority of rabbinic courts will not allow DNA evidence to determine the illegitimacy of a child. Because it has to be determined by witness testimony, and there's also a legal aspect involved, and this is a complicated issue, and I apologize for simplifying a very complicated legal issue. There is also a concern within Jewish law not to seek out whether individuals are illegitimate or not because of the profound ramifications of that determination. Because once an individual is found to be a legal mamzer, a legal bastard, according to the eyes of Jewish law, that person and his progeny forever cannot marry into the Jewish community. So there are nuances within the Jewish law where the science may be rejected because of internal legal reasoning, even though a scientist would say, how could you not accept the fact that this DNA evidence seems to prove with definity that this child is not the legal child? So there is an internal legal element which doesn't necessarily always universally accept the DNA. Shifting to other areas, we'll just gloss over this. Now you have sheep walking around who are grazing, who have a certain percent of human cells in their, whose livers are comprised of human cells. So does DNA determine whether these sheep are animals, whether these sheep are humans? They're doing it really for organ transplantation. They inject stem cells into the sheep. So if you have a sheep that's walking around, it's 51% animal cells, or 51% human cells and 49% animal cells, does DNA determine the status of that sheep? Or do other issues determine the status of that sheep? In other words, can you shech that sheep? Can you slaughter that sheep? And can you eat that sheep? Can you eat the liver of that sheep when the cells of that liver are actually humanoid cells? And that brings us to our final discussion, which is really the determination of this new introduction of genomics and identity into the halachic literature. This is very, very new material. Even though the research has been going on for the last few years, these questions really haven't yet been asked to the great rabbinic authorities. So the questions that Professor Skorecki, the very provocative questions, haven't really been treated in the rabbinic literature as of yet. So just very briefly, in general, how is a Jew defined from a legal perspective? We heard a lot of discussion about how people define themselves. We heard a lot of discussion about cultural identity, cultural association with Judaism. But we didn't hear about what Jewish law considers to be a Jew by the law, by the rigid definition of the law. So there are a number of ways that one is defined as a Jew in Jewish law. One is maternal lineage, one whose mother is a Jew. Second one, as has been pointed out very clearly here, and obviously has a significant impact on population genetics, conversion. One who has undergone a formal conversion process according to the standards of Jewish law. And the third, which is a little more complicated to determine, but chazaka or presumptive evidence based on practices of family for generations that this person is accepted as a Jew. So Rabbi Blythe, for example, in an article on the Ethiopian and black Jewish communities that attempted to identify themselves as Jewish, whether they in fact would be considered Jewish or not Jewish, had to do largely with their with whether the communities not only identified themselves as Jewish from a cultural perspective, but actually accepted upon themselves the practice of Judaism And that might itself be sufficient in order to determine identity. And here you have Moses with the Ten Commandments, and the Medrash tells us that at the time of Matan Torah, at the time of Har Sinai, God said, bring me your genetic lineages to determine that you are of the Jewish community before you begin to receive the Torah. And we know, it's been alluded to briefly, but just to make it very clear, in the Orthodox Jewish tradition, Judaism is determined exclusively matrilineally. So even if you have the relationship, you know, even from either in vitro fertilization or an actual physical relationship between a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man, that child is 100% Jewish in the eyes of Jewish law. So the question is, which was alluded to by the cases of Professor Skorecki, does mitochondrial DNA then establish Jewishness? Because if it's a maternally derived aspect, and you now know that mitochondrial DNA is transmitted only maternally from generation to generation, and you have a woman who has not been practicing as Jewish, has never self-identified as Jewish, but now does a test of genetic ancestry and says on your maternal side you're very highly percent Jewish, is this going to be accepted in a court of Jewish law? So I think the answer to that, at least at this stage, and maybe probably in the foreseeable future, is a no. It doesn't meet any of the classic criteria, and as we said, even DNA, which is almost 100% certain, is not accepted in certain legal areas. For sure, this science, while it's an exploding science, a fascinating science, is not a science which rises to the level of certainty that DNA does in terms of determination of maternity or paternity. One aspect which we didn't discuss here in genomic research is some other ramifications which might arise, and that's the possibility that some of our own enemies might be related to us. So there are studies going on, and maybe Professor Skorecki knows of these studies. The ethnic group at the heart of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan may have descended from their Jewish enemy, according to researchers in India. Experts at Mumbai National Institute believe that Pashtuns could be one of the 10 lost tribes. So, you know, I don't know, first of all, I don't know what would motivate someone to do this kind of research, but assume that it is borne out, I don't know what the ramifications would be. And just we'll be finished within the next 5 minutes. We'll address the Cohen gene and return to Professor Skorecki's cases, and we'll close for the day. So I actually spoke to a friend of mine who is a physician, a frum fellow, a nice Jewish fellow, who is a OBGYN in Iraq right now. And I told him about my presentation. His name is Dr. Shoal Weinreb, a good friend. And he actually wrote me, he goes, an anesthesiologist here in Iraq is named Shapiro. He is a Catholic whose paternal grandfather was Jewish. He was quite pleased to be able to find himself a carrier of the Cohen gene. Just thought that was interesting. And I did find that very interesting. And it shows you, again, the widespread aspect of this gene, of this testing. Now, Kohanim is radically different than the definition of Jewishness. Jewishness is clearly not genetic because there have been conversions, and it's something, obviously, which has been an integral part of the Jewish community forever. So it's not something which clearly is identifiable as a Jewish gene. And even the conclusion here was there is no one single gene that is identifiable as the Jewish gene. But with respect to the Cohen gene, that's a different story. There has to be direct, absolute transmission of paternity from father to son through all the generations in order for someone to retain that Kohen status. And as Professor Skorecki said, we just read this week about how the Kohanim were designated. They were designated from the times of Aaron and onward. And all Aaron's progeny transmitted maternally would be considered Kohanim. And as we said, it's transmitted maternally. And in the times of the temple, when the Kohanim were serving in the temple, they had to come into the chamber of hewn stone, the Lishkat HaGazit, and they would get grilled about their lineage until there was absolute clarity that their lineage traced themselves back to someone who was a Kohen who served in the temple, whose genetic lineage was unimpeachable. And then and only then could they serve in the temple with the clarification of that lineage. We do not have that kind of determination today. It simply doesn't exist. And in fact, the Rambam says, even in the times of the Rambam, which is many years, centuries ago, Kol Kohanim Bizman Hazeh Bechazakahim Kohanim. All the Kohanim that exist today are not so-called Kohanim Yuchas, means that their genetic lineage is known with absolute certainty. It is only known as a presumption. And we operate on that presumption, and we use that presumption. And in fact, in the 15th century, and this might explain some of the research that Professor Skorecki is doing, Shlomo Luria says, Baba Noseinu Meirova Rikus Agolos, because of the great exile, and because of all these times we've been exiled from many countries, there has been a confusion of all the lineage. And Zera Kohanim Levim Karov Levadai Shiz Balbalu. It's almost 100% that there's been a dilution of the lineage of the Kohen, and the Kohen lineage doesn't exist. So what would be the theoretical potential uses for this Kohen gene? One is the case that Professor Skorecki mentions, to remove existing Kohen status. So you have an individual who's a Kohen, wants to marry someone who would normally be prohibited for him, but at that time, so says, you know, I'll do genetic testing, and I'll say that I'm not really a Kohen, and then I can marry this divorcee. So this question was already asked and answered in the 17th century. And here you have a passage from the Maharit, who said a young man was a Kohen, his father was a Kohen, his grandfather was a Kohen, and he wanted to marry a divorcee. And he said, you know, this Kohanim thing, we're just Kohanim by presumption anyway. I'm not really a Kohen. I changed my mind. I'm not really a Kohen. I don't want to practice as a Kohen anymore, and I want to marry this woman. So what he said is that you can't do that. Once you have accepted as a family tradition of performing as a Kohen, and you have performed as a Kohen, your father's performed as a Kohen, then that's the way you will remain in the eyes of Jewish law, and you cannot renege your status as a Kohen. Another area where it might be interesting in the Kohen gene is to verify an unverified Kohen. So when the time comes, and Professor Skorecki alluded to this, when the time comes and the third temple is built, who's going to be able to serve as a Kohen? You have to have a verified status of a Kohen. Nobody has a verified status of a Kohen. So the answer is, the Mashiach is going to have to come, the Messiah is going to have to come and make that determination, because we can't make that determination. So would we be able to use the Y chromosome determination? So the reason you cannot use that Y chromosome determination is for the following. The presence of the Kohen gene may confirm paternal lineage to a Kohen, but first, it does not in any way determine if the individual is Jewish. All it determines that his paternal lineage goes back. All these generations back, the mother could have been non-Jewish completely. So the person may not even be halakhically Jewish. And furthermore, if indeed Jewish, there's no humanly possible way to determine if that Kohen is a cholol or not. And a cholol is an invalidated Kohen for a Kohen who married someone that they shouldn't have married, a divorcee or another kind of person that's prohibited to them. So its practical application in terms of determination of Kohen status is really not possible today. So in answer to the questions of Professor Skorecki, very briefly, this person who's 28 years old, who's been practicing as a Kohen, clearly could not renege his Kohen status based on any DNA testing whatsoever. Can a woman return or establish Jewishness based on mitochondrial DNA? At least not at this stage in halakhic history, is that something possible? And the third one is this Brazilian man who traces his history back to the conversos. If he himself doesn't have a direct line of acceptance of the rabbinic tradition of Jewish law, then there's no way to establish it based on that only ancestral lineage. And finally, the fourth case for you to think about as we conclude, and I challenge this to our presenters, if an Ashkenazi man is found to have 51% of his genome derived from Sephardic origins, may he now eat rice on Passover. Thank you very much.